We'll learn how people cope with strikes in Italy in just a bit. Right now, actress and writer Madhur Jaffrey is our guest as she shares memories from growing up in India and the power of flavors, smells, and even the simple elegance of a plain ripe mango to bring back the comforts of childhood. I always say India is my favorite country on this planet because it really mixes up all of my cultural furniture. It rearranges in ways I didn't know was possible, and it humbles my ethnocentricity. I grew up thinking I knew what pain was, what time was, what love was, what music was. And they go to India, and there's a billion people who see it differently.
Yeah.
And for me, that's one of the celebrations of travel, and it's a beautiful opportunity. You've done a beautiful job of packaging these observations because you had the opportunity to grow up in India and then live
in Britain and here in America, in the United States.
Now, you said during your childhood, it didn't occur to you that families could come in sizes of less than 30 people. Big families were the norm.
Yeah, because you always lived with your grandfather.
Many generations.
Yes, three generations were nearly always together.
Okay. So it wasn't that one woman would have 30 children.
No, it was that you'd have everybody, the extended family together. Yes, and a whole lot, there was comfort in that. There was also things that were not so nice about a big joint family like that. But I think there's great solace for children. There's a great sense of belonging for children.
But this was almost economic necessity, I think.
It wasn't in our case.
It wasn't, because your family was well off.
Yeah,
then.
It wasn't at all. It was just my grandfather felt it was the right thing, that we should all be together. And he didn't let us leave. My father wanted very much to have his own household, but my grandfather said no. And in those days, you listened to your father. This thing about respect for elders was still there in India, very much so.
Yeah. You know, it's so important when we do travel in India to travel in a way where we actually get away from our comfort zone and connect with the real people. I remember when I was in India, Madhur, you could take a tour of Bombay or whatever, and there'd be two tours, one for tourists and one for Indian travelers, because there's a lot of Indian travelers.
Of course.
And they would have the same route. But one would be in a fancier bus and go to restaurants in a hotel. And the other one would be in a simpler bus and they would go to very characteristic restaurants. In one, you'd eat with spoons and forks, and the other, you'd eat with your fingers.
Yes.
And I would save about 75% by taking the local tour.
Yeah.
And I think I would have triple the experience.
Yeah. I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did.
It's a shame if somebody goes to India and never eats with their fingers.
Well, I have to tell you, I was in Korea once and writing about Korean food, and there was this lady who cooked wonderful food for me. She was a cooking teacher, among other things. A very aristocratic kind of lady. And she says, I don't understand how you can eat with your fingers. Because they eat with these knitting needle-type metal chopsticks in Korea.
Metal chopsticks, okay.
So I said, I was so incensed, but she was my hostess, and I didn't want to say anything that was not correct. So I said, Madam, how would you feel about making love with metal chopsticks?
Bingo. What did she say?
She was just quiet for a second.
So that's my experience. In India, it's not a matter of elegance or class or upbringing. It is just correct in certain cases to eat with your fingers.
It is. And you wash your hands before, you wash your hands after. James Beard, whom I worked with a lot, he used to say that hands are the best implement.
Yeah.
And he used to actually whisk with his hand. And he used to lift things with his hands, opening up his fingers, lift, you know, foods up with his hands. And he developed a pair of, I guess you call them spoons for lifting salad up.
Right.
Which were like two hands made of wood.
I
wonder why nobody took that over from him. I still have his hands, the two wooden hands that he designed. But they're absolutely the best thing for picking up salad.
I vividly remember going into fancy restaurants in India where I don't think there was a spoon and fork in the place. And there was like, I seem to remember a ceremonial sink in the middle of the room where elegant people would wash their hands.
Right.
And it just felt right to eat with the fingers God gave you for eating.
Because you can manipulate so much better. You don't have peas slipping off.
But there's some tricks. For a long time, I was trying to shuffle it in, not realizing I had to use gravity, and I'd use my thumb as an ice cream spoon
flicker.
To push
it up.
And then there's an art of eating soup with your fingers also.
Yeah, there is. I can't explain that so well.
That was South India.
In the North, we don't do that. And we really do eat with only the end digits of our fingers.
Okay.
And we usually use bread to pick up the food.
Okay. So farther south, you'll have
more of that. More wet food.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Madhur Jaffrey. Her book is Climbing the Mango Trees, and you can learn more about her work at madhur-jaffrey.com, madhur-jaffrey.com. Madhur, you're a cook and an actress, yet you wrote a memoir. What do you hope that people will take away from reading Climbing the Mango Trees?
I don't know why I wrote the memoir, and I don't know what people will take away from it. I wrote it. I didn't want to write it. My editor absolutely insisted that I write it. And I knew there were going to be difficulties in writing it because the minute you bear, you can't just bear yourself. That would be fine. But you have to bear a few other people with you. Mm-hmm. And that's not always very pleasing to the other people whose lives you're sharing. And that was very hard. So I don't know what I expect people to get from it. I hope they learn a little bit about India of a certain mm-hmm. period, mm-hmm. Which not much has been written about this period post and pre-independence.
Right.
And I hope I will show them a period that they've never really intimately known before from one person's point of view.
And there's an intimacy when you get beyond the headlines and you just climb the mango tree and you recall the little joys of life.
Exactly.
You know, when I want to recall my own childhood, the comfort food I seek out would be, I think back, what did my mother make for me? And it was like beef stew and cornbread and apple cobbler. Mm-hmm. What's the one dish that your mother used to make for you that brings you right back to your childhood in Delhi?
I think it's what we call dal, which is beans, split peas and beans, made with, so we would have mung dal, which is mung beans without mm-hmm. their skin and split. And they would be cooked very simply, and we would have them with basmati rice. And those two smells, the smell of basmati rice cooking in the kitchen and that plain dal with one little vegetable is to me heaven still. I can live on that.
Even for a tourist, that's comfort food.
It is comfort food.
I remember when I was
It's like rice and beans in Latin America.
It was just bring on the dal.
Yeah, bring on the dal.
Madhur Jaffrey, your editor was very smart to recognize that you had a beautiful book hiding inside of you that was even more than a cookbook.
It was
It was a cultural cookbook. And best wishes. You've got me fantasizing about climbing the mango trees in corners far, far away.
Thank you.
Perhaps it's no coincidence that two of my favorite countries in the world are also known for being untidy, even chaotic, when all you want to do is something simple like buy a ticket for a train. Leaving India, let's check in now with a couple of friends who live in Italy for an intimate look at chaos Italian style. Traveling in Italy is so rewarding, but those who can handle the chaos that comes with Italy enjoy it even more. I'm joined now by Cecilia Bottai from Umbria in Orvieto and Anne Long, an American who 34 years ago moved to Italy and makes her home in Sorrento. Thank you, Cecilia and Anne, for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Now, when I'm in Italy, the way people line up can be exasperating. Anne, you've lived in Italy for 34 years. How do you handle the lines in Italy?
There is no line. It's a concept, but it's never a reality. They're mainly horizontal. They're never vertical. They're very polite. They'll even butt in front of you being polite because they just have to ask a question. But that question then becomes doing what they had to do and they bumped you out of line, but they're very nice about it.
Very polite. What I do very politely when I'm out of line at a ticket office at the train station is when I get within arm's reach of the desk, I put my arm up to the window so nobody can crowd in front of me on the left-hand side, and I let the three people in front of me do their work, but nobody's going to cut the line in front of me.
The short ones can get under your arm.
Cecilia, your family's been from Italy for forever. How do you handle the lines?
As Anne said, there are no lines. Somewhere they have numbers you can get so that you are number 23 and you are number 23. That's in a hospital if you have to have blood analysis done. That in some offices, but in a post office, we don't have the system, for instance. So you have to be smart enough, watch your shoulders, watch your front. And this is a nice way to start talking to the people, because if you want to be polite, so not rude, you don't show that you're just watching your shoulders because you don't want the people to go in front of you. You just find a good reason to talk to them. But this is the way it is, and we won't change it.
Well, that would make sense to get into a conversation, and then it'd be pretty tough to crowd in front of a person you're talking with, but keep your elbows sharpened. Now, what about strikes? When I'm in Italy, I don't think I've ever gone to Italy when there wasn't a strike, threatened at least. What's your experience with strikes, Anne?
Well, they like to strike. Once you've been here a while, you know that they are doing them certain months. Mm-hmm. You'll never have a strike in July and August because they're off on vacation. Why would they strike? They don't strike in December when it's Christmas. But when they come back after the holidays in the summer, be careful because October can be a month where they start striking.
What is the word for strike?
A chopero.
Chopero. You'll see signs and you should be tuned into that.
That's right. And listen, ask people, ask at the hotel. They've been talking about it weeks ahead of time in the newspaper or whatever.
So there's a strike next Thursday on the trains. Either leave before or stay a little longer. Or if you're going to leave, I find that trains go on strike a lot. If you just go to the train station and get on any train that's going in that direction, just keep working your way to your destination. Nobody knows when the next train's going, but these are kind of like nuisance strikes. It seems like Cecilia, in the United States, if something goes on strike, they're closed down for weeks. But in Italy, it's just an inconvenience, an intentional inconvenience.
Absolutely, I agree. So a strike is hardly ever that dramatic. If the gas stations are on strike, they are on strike for a couple of days with a but. Mm-hmm. But those will work. If there is a bus strike, it's a strike, but a few buses will run. So it's always a strike with a but. So it's a paid holiday.
They're just messing people up.
Just messing people, yeah.
In Italy, it's famous for chaotic traffic, but I've known lately the traffic's getting a lot better in Italy.
Yeah, this is an effect due to economy. Economy is not doing that well. Gasoline is extremely expensive. So people use more public transportation. And even they drive slower because you need less gas. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an idea, traffic in Rome has diminished by 25% in the last year. This is because people use more the metro or the bus. Even if they have to stay longer on a bus before getting to their office, they have to do it because they can't make it to the end of the month otherwise. So this is the only reason for which traffic has gotten better.
And what is your experience with traffic in Italy?
Well, I come from Naples. Naples is the capital of just a mishmash of traffic and things. It doesn't matter what they charge for the gas, they mm-hmm. always have to be out. There's too many people in too small a space. It's like sand in a bottle with stones. Wherever there's a gap, that's where they're going to be.
The traffic will go.
So you know, motorbikes and everything.
In Italy, historically, the cars are littering the sidewalks.
That's right.
And then they put these posts to define the sidewalks, and it keeps the cars off the sidewalks.
Parking there, yeah.
And that's been a big improvement, I think, over the years.
They put a note very often, especially in the cities, they put a note, if you need me to remove the car, this is my phone number you can call me at, with the exception of the fact that if you don't speak Italian, you don't understand. So this is a quite common attitude in the large cities,
many
especially
times,
in Rome.
I've been on a bus, and many times there's a little peanut-sized car blocking the road. I mean, there's no way anybody could get by, much less our tour bus. And the guy thought, well, I'll just go run and do my errand. And we literally have to get out of the bus, and we get six strong men and move the car onto the sidewalk so we can drive through. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about navigating the chaos of Italy in our next trip. And what is the Italian feeling about the craziness of life there? Do you recognize it, or is everybody else just strangely organized?
No, we are used to it. And, you know, when we talk about Italy, it depends on where. Chaos can be more or less intense. But we are used to it, so we always find a way around. It's a good way to train yourself. Since we're born with it, you know that you have to find yourself around. Because you wake up a morning and you don't know how you're going to finish the day. Every day is a conquer. That is what we say.
Every day is a conquer. So there's a challenge to conquer every day.
Absolutely.
And you have to be creative.
More than creative. Quick and creative. So you have to create quickly.
Okay. Now, if you go to Germany and it's so efficient and so organized, does it just feel like boring?
No, it's different.
Yeah.
You know that there is no creation required, but sometimes it gets a bit too flat to me.
Anne Long, you've lived in Italy for 34 years. Does it feel workable? How do you deal with the frustrations that come with becoming an Italian if you're used to American efficiency?
I don't know if you ever really get used to it. You accept it. You learn that if you fight it, it's going to be worse than if you just accept it. And you try to see the funny side of it.
Now, am I making too big a deal out of it, or is it really as chaotic and crazy as it seems to a tourist?
It's awful. It's awful. And I say further south you go, the worse it gets in Italy. I'm down by Naples, and they invented the word for chaos. And they haven't invented a cure because they just like it the way it is.
Cecilia, is this true that the chaos gets a little chaotic or more chaotic as you go farther south?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Because the country, I mean, Italy has been influenced all its life long by the history. And in the north, they are more Germans or they're more French, and everything is better organized. Mm-hmm. The farther south you go, the more is like the Arabian style. And you know that it's more flexibility in that culture. So this is why. And the difference is also between large cities and small towns. So,
How so?
Orvieto has 22,000 inhabitants. Rome has 4 million people. I split myself between Rome and Orvieto. I know that when I go out in Rome to do three things, I'm lucky enough if I can do one. If I go out in Orvieto to do three things, I do the three plus another one.
Something that's fascinating to me is the sport of tax evasion in Italy. And I know they've had laws recently that require businesses to give people a receipt and actually require purchasers to keep that receipt within 50 meters or something of the coffee shop or whatever. Cecilia, what is the ethic in Italy about paying taxes, and how is the government trying to get people to be honest?
Well, to be honest, my answer is everybody would be happy to pay taxes if you get something in return. The problem is that very often we pay a lot and we get very little. And that is what drives Italians crazy. Also, we have some people who can avoid paying taxes because they have something that is not on their name. The money they make can be made under the name of somebody else. So the percentage is lower.
Oh, so if you can divide your income in two, you're at a lower tax bracket? Is that the idea?
You put it under somebody else's name.
So you're still paying tax on it, but at a lower level?
No,
You're not? You're just putting it under a fictitious name. So this is your side business that's basically...
Well, you know, if you put it under your a child's name that's 18, who's not making any other money, you don't pay taxes amount of money.
So, Anne, tell us more, because you come from, you're an American, but you've lived in Italy for 34 years. What is striking to you about the Italian approach to taxes?
Well, see, we're so used to our liberties here in America, and just the fact that in Italy now with the new laws, the police can go into your bank account and look at it, and they can check and see the movement. And if you've got money coming in and they have no reason to know where that money's coming from, they can come audit you.
Is that right?
It's absolutely right, and they're getting stronger and stronger. The problem is still corruption, which is if I have the right connection with the finanza, that is the police that is meant to check on your taxes or what, then by coincidence, nobody will check on your account. By coincidence, under the office of that specific doctor who makes an enormous amount of money, there is never the finanza checking.
And so tell me about the new ability of the government to check stuff.
Well, I'm on, you know, being an American, I'm used to having privacy and things that there you have different rights and whatever. But with your bank account in Italy, the police can just go into any bank account and check to see where your money's coming from.
So the Italian IRS can actually look into your bank account and know exactly.
And with no reason to. They can just check it if they see it.
So, Cecilia, this is a big change, I think.
Yeah, that's a big change. And I absolutely agree. They can do it. It's something they really can do without problem, with the exception of the fact that if you know people in that specific branch of the police and you don't want them to look into your account, they will not do it.
So this is what is really quite amazing about Italy. That is really hard for me to imagine. But even in this day and age, in Italy, they can look into your bank account. But if you're well connected with the IRS guy, your family's all right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you for this little insight into Italy. And good luck sorting this out. Because we want the magic and the chaos of Italy. But we also want Italy to hold together.
We'll do our best.
It's all right. Part and package.
Mille grazie, and I'll see you next time in Italy, okay?
Okay.
Ciao. Okay.
Thank you very much. Arrivederci.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, with Sarah McCormick and Isaac Kaplan-Wohner. Thanks to the BBC in New York for their help this week. There's more in the radio section of ricksteves.com. You'll find links to our guests, and you can listen to any week's show on demand. Join us again next week for more Travel with Rick Steves.